Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American power, politics and prejudices. The election is over, but the Americano never stops and there will be a lot to talk about with the second Trump administration. And so we'll bring you more and more Americano because judging from the feedback, that's what you guys want. So please keep listening. This is our last Americano of the year, an emergency one, really, because we thought we should do a podcast about the death of Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, who died aged 100 last weekend on Sunday. And there's already been a lot of tributes and a lot of commentary from all sorts of people across the world. And to discuss this, I'm delighted to be joined by our political correspondent, James Heal, who is something of a Carter expert, having written an obituary about him. James, you regard Carter, as quite a few people do, as somebody who did more out of office than in office. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I think that certainly the post-war American presidents, he will be remembered mostly for what he did outside the White House than inside it, you know, the most powerful office in the Western world. And I think that speaks to two things, one of which was his obvious longevity. He outlived not one, but two of his obituary writers, quite the feat. It was 43 years after he left the White House. And second of all, to the sheer scale of his activity. I mean, just to take one example, there was a great piece in the Times in London last year about how he had committed himself in 1980 to eradicate the Guinea worm, which is a parasite. 40 years ago, that was infecting a million people across the world. Horrible, horrible disease. Last year, it was just 4 people were infected. So he's basically eradicated the Guinea worm. And for those efforts in terms of disease control and work around the world in political humanitarian causes, he was awarded the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, 2002. And, you know, 4 US presidents have been awarded them. Teddy Roosevelt was one of them. Barack Obama was another. And the fourth was Woodrow Wilson. I think of all those 4, Jimmy Carter probably has the strongest claims to actually being a man of peace. So I think that he will be remembered as much for out of it rather than inside office, where he was regarded as a below average US president by most experts, but probably better regarded as a very highly regarded ex-president than he was in office.
Well, he was also more of a sort of liberal spiritual figure to a lot of people, almost like a kind of pope of the Democratic Party to a lot of people. And that's because he was a Christian, quite a devout man, and full of a kind of passionate intensity that didn't suit politics, really, didn't suit the rough and tumble of politics. And yet he became president. How was he able to ascend the greasy pole, get into the White House? As his background was that he was a peanut farmer who then became governor of Georgia, but how was he able to succeed in politics? Because the way we talk about him now, it's as though he was not really a political figure at all.
Yes, absolutely. And there is this tendency, Freddie, which you reflect in your piece on Jimmy Carter, to venerate people after their death and treat them more like a sort of pope than a president. And actually, of course, Jimmy Carter was in charge of the United States military at the time of the Cold War. There were various sort of operations going on all across the world that even the most saintly of commanders-in-chief wouldn't have been able to kind of disown all authority for, despite some of his previous comments in his life. He was able to get elected for two reasons, I think, one of which was he was a figure who suited the times. In the seedy 70s, after Watergate, after all the crises of the Johnson administration and Vietnam, he was untouched and untainted by all of that. This was an outsider. He was the first governor-president, which kicked off a succession of different leaders, you know, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, who all marketed themselves as, and Donald Trump, of course, anti-Washington politics, all outsiders. And so he came up in 1976, really was a long shot for the presidency, and marketed himself in this very humble way as the peanut farmer from Georgia. But the second reason why he got elected, simply put, he was a good politician. He was an astute politician, which is what you need if you are going to become president of the United States. He was able to very cynically market himself in such a way as to appeal to the Democrats in 1976. For instance, after losing the Massachusetts primary, he was there walking up at the St. Patrick's Day parade with a badge saying on, "England, get out of Ireland." You know, he was someone who was able to play because he was very much aware of the other primaries in the New England race for presidency that year. So he was someone who's always very able to appeal to different voter bases. The danger, of course, was that he was able to get elected as president. And then once he was in office, he was found out, partly because I think the challenges of the late 1970s would have overwhelmed any incumbent, and I think there are certain parallels you can draw with Jim Callaghan here in the UK as well. But second of all, I think that just that he saw inflation, for instance, as a moral phenomenon rather than an economic one. And I think that was partly his undoing. So in some ways, the traits which built him up and got him into office as a very sort of pure moralizing leader, once in office, quickly became rather irritating. He was seen as somewhat hectoring as a president. And actually that served to only further his downfall at the hands of Ronald Reagan 4 years later.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, that was where the so-called malaise speech really hurt him, was because he was seen to be causing the problems and then blaming Americans for the problems that he had caused, which is not where you want to be as a politician.
No, completely. And also, I think that it just spoke to such an outdated concept of the nation. So in some ways, Jimmy Carter was a harbinger of change, someone who was the first of his kind, a sort of governor. But in other ways, he was also the last gasp of a different era. You know, he saw things as a moral phenomena rather than actually having a kind of Milton Friedman approach about looking at the problem's underlying causes. So he, you know, goes on TV, makes this sort of very kind of schoolmarmy speech talking about voluntary wage and price targets. And of course, to a modern age, that looks just so outdated, because we've had sort of 30, 40 years of monetarist theory that's followed that. And as you say, Freddie, I think that Jimmy Carter was in some ways almost too unwilling and unbending for his own good. And actually, the politicians who came later were always willing to stress their politics in a way which didn't imply kind of trade-offs. And I think that Jimmy Carter can be commended for his honesty in some ways, but also, I think, almost suicidal honesty, which obviously served to only hurt his re-election chances. And again, another example of that in terms of appointments. And some ways when we look at these legacies, we like to forget things. So it wasn't all kind of corporatism up until the election of Reagan. Paul Volcker, who was the Fed chairman who did so much to tame inflation in the 1980s, you know, seen as a great sort of Reagan figure, he was appointed by Jimmy Carter. And actually, his actions in charge of the Fed only hurt Carter's choices in terms of the 1980 presidential election, because he embarked on a really big campaign to get the dollar back under control in terms of inflationary spiral.
And talking about inflation, that's probably a good point of comparison with Joe Biden, because they are the only two one-term, just four-year Democratic presidents. And they both experienced inflation. They both presided over inflationary periods, and that is, as we've seen at the ballot all over the Western world in the last few years, that is toxic electorally, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And inflation often becomes this political machismo test. And in terms of what happened with Carter, was he was seen as weak abroad and weak at home. You think of the Iran hostage crisis. There are certain analogies and parallels with Biden, who of course was a senator and learning a lot from the Carter administration when he was there in the early 1970s, in his 30s and 40s. And so for Biden, the obvious analogy is with Afghanistan and the disastrous pullout there, seen as a loss of prestige, American symbol of authority. That was very much a fear that was present in 1970s American politics. If anything, I think you could say probably that the economy's done probably slightly better did under Joe Biden than it did under Jimmy Carter. But the reality is that both of them just seem to have been outgunned at home, outmatched abroad. And I do think there's that sense of malaise which is creeping in. It's worth noting that in the final days of Jimmy Carter's time in office, Afghanistan was invaded by the Soviets, and that really marked what we didn't know at the time, but the beginning of the end of the Cold War, because the Soviets were so overstretched there. And I think right now some would see a sort of analogy between that and, say, China, in terms of fears about American prowess in the world, concerns about the economy at home, inability to control it, while also sort of seeing an economy which isn't as robust as people want, which is why, of course, he was now being a one-term president.
Well, and indeed, it was Carter, was it not, who started funding the Mujahideen?
Yeah.
Something that I've seen a bit about it, but not really enough, because it is such a significant part of his presidency, is the his Panama Canal Treaty. Can you take us through what he was doing there and why it's significant?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was obviously, you know, one of those long-running issues for American leaders, successive ones. And it basically, in 1964, there were a series of riots which threatened to close down the canal. And the Panamanians have been demanding it back. It was clearly seen as a bit of a core celebrity in liberal Democrat circles. And so over the course of his presidency, he gets elected at the beginning of January 1977. By September of that year, he negotiates two treaties, the first of which is the canal is going to be jointly operated by America and Panama until the end of the century. And at the end of the 20th century, it would be controlled by Panama alone. But obviously, it was Carter tried to market it in a way which was saying, you know, we've got safeguards, it's going to give America the right to defend the canal against attack, guarantee passage for its ships in emergency. But there was an almighty struggle to get it through Congress. And, you know, I see it again, there's a certain parallel with what's going on with the Chagos Islands right now, whether Donald Trump's going to intervene in that here in the UK. So it took until spring of 1978, approved by the Senate, and then 1979 had to be implemented by the House of Representatives. And Ronald Reagan, of course, this is a great boon to his campaign, to Republicans anywhere. As so often, Democrat kind of overreach in foreign policy and contentious issues serves to as a fillip to Republican chances. And so the Republicans go really hard in campaigning against this. And it, and again, allows Ronald Reagan to paint him as completely weak. So Reagan says that Carter and supporters are acting in Congress like Santa Claus. They've given the Panama Canal away. And again, it paints this whole picture. The Panama Canal issue is then used to sort of talk about Taiwan with its failure to stand up for them against China and a SALT II treaty as well. So it was all part of this whole image of weakness, etc. And a Republican said, you know, Teddy Roosevelt took over the Panama Canal and then Jimmy Carter gave it back. And that served to be one of those often overlooked reasons for the Republican success of 1980.
And the Republican success was significant. It was a landslide win for Reagan. And obviously we've discussed inflation. We've discussed the sort of perceived weakness abroad, but that in 1980, that was really intensified by the Iran hostage crisis. And it's sort of overlooked, isn't it, as a foreign policy issue for Americans. And it explains, I think, some of the hostility that Americans feel towards Iranians that perhaps Brits don't, is that hostage crisis, because it was such a big story and it went on for so long and it hurt Carter so badly.
Yes, and the way in which it was done was deliberately targeted against him as well. I don't think Americans necessarily were in great sympathy with Jimmy Carter, but you can even be a Republican and consider how partisan the Iranians were being. It clearly wasn't a great issue of state. They released the hostages on the sort of final days before he was about to leave the presidency and Ronald Reagan took over. And I think that the bungled nature of that, and which Jimmy Carter were authorised a way for the US servicemen to go and rescue the hostages, only served to compound that sense. I think that post-Vietnam War sense of failure and shame, and that America was no longer going to be a great power. So those insecurities were all fed into this. And as you say, Freddie, I mean, since the 1950s, the UK, when we sort of abdicated our responsibilities as an imperial power in that region, has had very little to do with Iran, relatively, whereas America, obviously, there's perennial issues by being the major power in the Middle East. So that is the way in which the Iranians conducted themselves in that, specifically to hurt Jimmy Carter, much like in some ways you could say perhaps 10 years earlier, the North Vietnamese had sort of held up the process of peace negotiations during the 1968 campaign, I think left a very bitter taste in the mouth. And it's probably one of the reasons why so many Republicans have been always so hawkish on Iran, because they are aware of how damaging it was to Jimmy Carter's chances in 1980.
And Carter became this sort of figure of peace, ambassador for peace in the Middle East, obviously not entirely successful, but that's very much became the focus of his post-presidential work, didn't it?
Yes, it was. And I think that it's obviously an attempt to try and rehabilitate himself to an extent, but also I think it was something he genuinely was moved by. In office, you can point to the fact that he was able to be relatively a fiscal hawk on spending, and in terms of defence spending, he was obviously a more kind of pro-peace legacy than other presidents which followed him. So Ronald Reagan, of course, there was the liberal intervention doctrine. The 1990s, it was the sort of unipower, and so you have American intervention in a whole sphere of areas. There was relatively little of that kind of military conflict under Jimmy Carter's time. Obviously, there is the Mujahideen funding, as you say. So I think that that was something that was important to him, and he continued it out. There are questions about some of the work, for instance, in terms of the election integrity in Venezuela and what he did to kind of effectively whitewash Maduro's regime there at the beginning. But it was clearly something that he felt very strongly about. And I think that in some ways, when someone, a great figure, loses, they become much more of a kind of cuddly, acceptable underdog. And so Everall, therefore, was willing to kind of champion Jimmy Carter's work. It was seen as not particularly partisan. The interesting thing, though, just reflecting on this conversation, Freddie, is how little of a kind of political tradition he left behind. Because when you read the contemporary accounts of the 1970s and 80s, it's not just the right attacking him. It's not just the, you know, Republicans like Reagan saying he was an appeaser, he was weak. On the left, you've got the great liberals of the Kennedy tradition. And of course, Ted Kennedy ran against him in 1980 and just lost. And they're bemoaning how little vision this man has. If he looks at someone, he's penny pinching, he's unwilling. He's, I think, of all the five predecessors, he's the most willing to not increase non-defense spending in terms of government expenditure. He is a fiscal hawk, relatively. And they bemoan the fact that he has no vision. There's no great society for Jimmy Carter. And that's probably why, in some ways, he's left a legacy, partly because I think the left is embarrassed about some of his faith, or that faith-based politics and that evangelical sort of element to it. And I think also it's about he just didn't come from a sort of big society tradition. And actually, if you look at the kind of great liberal myth-making, the Kennedy clan and always saw him as very much the enemy. And there's a great bit from one of his diaries in, I think it's in 76, Jimmy Carter, when he writes about how he refuses to kiss Teddy Kennedy's ass to secure the nomination. And there was really a sense of a clashing of two traditions there. And so in some ways, what's interesting is then when the Democrats do regain the White House 12 years after Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton is very keen not to portray himself as a Jimmy Carter figure in lots of different ways. So although Jimmy Carter, did a lot of great work out of office, I think in the last 40 years or so, 43 years, it is perhaps noticeable that so few Democrats, maybe conscious of his loser tag, his loser tradition, have been unwilling to kind of associate himself with his legacy to an overt extent in office.
But he is popular in some ways among the sort of the new left for his work against corruption. And for his sort of his purity of purpose when it came to the economy.
Yes, and there is that sense that he clearly was not going to be doing the kind of enriching speeches that you see here of like Tony Blair in the UK or other presidents who go around seemingly only trying to further their own pockets. And the man himself is respected for his way in which he conducted his life. If you read some of his last interviews in sort of 2021, 2022, he's talked about life with Rosalind, who he's married to for 77 years. And I think people do respect that across the spectrum. In terms of the new left, as you say, there, he was not seen as someone who was trying to further his own goals. So I think you can respect the man. But in terms of his politics and his sort of political embodiment in office, I think that there's a sense perhaps of nostalgia, but actually very few are sort of marketing themselves in an overt sort of humble Christian way like he was able to do successfully in the 1970s.
So Carter is, I think, fair to say, getting tributes all over the world. And I think they are sincere because, as discussed, he has been sort of his reputation as of this man of peace and a sort of non-politician figure. Joe Biden's legacy as a one-term president, do you think he will be looked back on? Because even though, you know, neither man was a successful president, but they are liked as people by liberal Americans. Do you think we could see a similarity, or is Biden too poisoned now by his time in office?
Well, I mean, I began this podcast by saying Carter was remembered what he did after office. Joe Biden may well be remembered what he did before office, because he had such a long time in the Senate for 35 odd years there, and then of course 8 years as vice president. It is very difficult, I have to say, at this point in time to see how Joe Biden is really going to be remembered necessarily as a sort of winner in 40 years time or so, distance from the time when he leaves the presidency. His main achievement, as it were, was supposedly cutting the era of Trump, of ending Trump's time in the White House and being the great liberal bulwark against the kind of forces that Trump supposedly represents. That's obviously now taken a huge blow with the loss. He can obviously go out there and say, well, I didn't fight that election, it was, you know, Kamala. But with that and potentially the conclusion of the Ukraine war, it is difficult to see what Joe Biden will rank any higher than middle of the presidents, probably lower section. You wonder, actually, which will be remembered more fondly in 40 years' time. And given the very mixed record of foreign policy of Biden, given the fact that there was, to an extent, an economic recovery post-COVID, but it was a voteless recovery, and given the fact that he wins as a one-term president, I think they'll probably remember it actually pretty much in the same breath. And again, given the forces of the Democrat Party, given the sort of the political culture that Joe Biden comes from is much less prevalent in the Democrat Party now, I suspect we will probably see him more as the sort of last gasp of an old order than the beginning of a brave new era, that the kind that, say, lots of people would say Ronald Reagan heralded in the 1980s.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, because, I mean, I suppose everything depends on how Trump 2.0 works as an administration. Because if Reagan's success almost defined Carter's failure, if Trump succeeds, if he, you know, revs up the economy, as a lot of Trump people think he's about to, and America kind of enjoys a new age or a new lease of life under Trump 2.0, then Biden will be seen as a similar failure to Carter with Reagan, even though we can probably discuss whether that's fair or not.
Absolutely. Though I do think it's interesting that just because of his age, Joe Biden, he won't be making a comeback in 4 years' time. And that was very different from the kind of era where I've just been reading Nixon Land, for instance, and all these politicians constantly sort of trade places. So, you know, Nixon runs for California governor in 62. 4 years later, Reagan succeeds where he fails. Nixon runs for president in 1960, comes back, obviously, 68. And then they're all the sort of swapping places in terms of there's a reversion and then there's a sort of a reset and a reorder, etc. So I'm not sure who would carry on a sort of a Biden legacy. I think it would be very different. And I think what they're having to cope with now, as you say, Freddie, is responding to the relative success of Donald Trump in reclaiming the White House, the breakdown of their traditional coalition, the kind of coalition that was so familiar to Joe Biden, of having a rainbow coalition, of having workers alongside African Americans, etc. You see increasingly those kind of coalition fraying, and it does feel as though we're kind of going through the post-Biden consensus, albeit we'll see what happens in terms of Trump, but the politics that Joe Biden represented, just like those of Jimmy Carter, increasingly don't seem to be the ones of the future, although we have to wait and see what happens in 4 years' time, of course.
We do indeed. James Heal, thank you very much for joining us. RIP to President Jimmy Carter, and I hope you all have a happy new year.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode of The Americano Show. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave rave reviews on whatever platform you listen to it on. I would like to thank, of course, my brilliant producer, Natasha Farrows. Thanks again for listening. All the best.